Presenting a proven way to build your endowment with a sustainable gift planning program, this is the Gift Planning Development Podcast, an ongoing forum designed to help you meet all of your gift planning goals.
Welcome to the Gift Planning Development Podcast. I'm your host today, Joe Tumalo, and I have my guest today, someone I've known for a long time, Brad Caswell. Welcome, Brad.
Thank you.
Great to have you here today. And Brad is president of Acadia Squam Group. And let's start the podcast with telling us what the heck does that mean, Acadia Squam Group.
It's a firm that we created recently to help with, that we want to help conversations at the DAFs across donor-advised funds across the country and charities in understanding how to work together. It came from my partner and I. My partner, Ben Peirce, is actually has a love of Maine and Acadia National Park up there, and I have a long-standing history with a place called Squam Lake in New England, so that's how Acadia Squam came together.
Wonderful. And Squam is S-Q-U-A-M.
Yes, correct.
And so while we're thinking of it, what's your website?
It's acadiasquam.com.
Acadia, that's A-C-A-D-I-A-S-Q-U-A-M.com.
Yes.
Great. So the overarching theme of our conversation is going to be donor advised funds. And a lot of people are talking about it. A lot of people are speaking about it at conferences and a lot of people are writing about it. So, but let's see what we can come up with that nobody's said yet. How's that for a challenge?
Okay. Let's give it a try.
Yeah. So you have some, you gave me some, a great outline to guide the conversation, and we got started to get into it. So just some stats. You were throwing out some interesting stats about the average size of, or the median size of donor advised funds. And you want to pick up a little bit on that, what we were talking about before?
Sure. So the point that we try to make about donor advised funds is that they are holding dollars already committed to philanthropy. The donors made a gift into those funds that is, the donor's already gotten a charitable deduction for. So those monies are already set aside for philanthropy. So the challenge that we try to help organizations and people with is, how do we get into those dollars? And there are significant dollars. To the numbers, the statistics side of it, there are, in the most recent survey of NPT regarding donor-advised funds, roughly $235,000 in the average DAF account. So there are 1,000 plus or minus DAF accounts out there. This is separate from donor-advised funds. I try to keep them separate. Donor-advised funds are the organizations that host donor-advised accounts. The accounts are the individual accounts within those funds. About 1,000 funds. There are roughly 450,000 accounts, and the dollars in those accounts that are held by in those accounts average about $235,000, according to the latest report. And so that's a significant pool of money already committed to philanthropy that we want to try to help charities find a way to tap into those dollars. If that makes sense.
Sure. Yeah. When you say the charities tap into it directly to the donor, of course, right?
Well, that's the interesting thing. In my years, having spent 12 years as the chief operating officer at Vanguard Charitable, there was an ongoing question of charities of, how can I call up Vanguard and the other major DAFs in the country and ask the question, can I get on your list of recommended charities so that your donors will know to give me money? And the conversation is, DAFs really, there are a lot of DAFs that aren't in the business of picking one charity over another. The community foundation world is a great world in the local geographies to know the charities of the area and to be able to support charities in a particular way in a geography. In the case of the national DAFs, of which there are roughly 50, they aren't really in a place to choose or recommend a DAF to a donor over another. And so a charity calling into a major DAF and saying, can I get on your preferred list, really isn't going to advance the conversation for them at all. It really, they have a nice conversation, and the answer at the end of the day is, no, we don't have a preferred list of charities. The tactic that I recommend to people is to think about the donors and understand that those donors they have that have DAF accounts are very committed philanthropists. They, on average, have $200,000 in their accounts. And so access to the funds in DAFs very much ought to be through the donors, not by calling up a DAF and saying, can I get on a preferred list? You can find out, you can figure out who your donors are that are DAF holders, DAF account holders, in a couple of different ways. One, the most obvious is when you get a check from a DAF, make sure you know who the underlying account holder is when that gift comes in, and make sure that you thank them to the extent that you can reach them, and recognize that that person who just gave you a $5,000 or a $20,000 gift from their DAF has more money back at that DAF. So cultivate that donor further to reach into those DAF dollars. And that's, go ahead.
Yeah, I did a little quick video blurb a couple months ago. My wife, Lorraine, and I have a donor advice fund. And I'm surprised at how many charities that we submit a grant to do not thank us. I was a little critical about it when I did the video, but not in like a way to make them wrong, but just a way to let's learn from that and recognize that that's happening. And I had one charity, made our first gift to. I called them, did you ever get the gift? And they said, yeah, we got it. I said, I didn't get it. I didn't get anything. And I asked them to send me a copy of the check, and it does have our address on there. So just as a side note, it seemed so much, in our, especially in the planned giving space, and not to dismiss the importance of talking about some of the more technical advanced stuff, but so often, a lot of what I talk about is the common sense stuff, but that's not always common practice.
Right. And I remember seeing your video and smiling because it is a very simple, straightforward thing to say thank you. And for the most part, the information you receive from a DAF about the check or the grant check that's being issued to you has enough information for you to go out to those donors. And again, knowing those donors and recognizing that there's a pool of money already set aside for philanthropy from those donors suggests the Tumalos are ready and willing to give you more money. They already have an interest in your mission because they gave you some money up front. So that's part, that's a big part of cultivating that donor to continue to be aware that they have those dollars in DAF accounts. And I think that thank you question is really important. And if, well, to change it slightly, charities often have called me and said, how do I get on the preferred list, or how do I make myself known to your donors in a DAF? And frankly, it's a pretty simple answer. If you don't know whether somebody's in a DAF, you should understand that most DAFs have pretty sophisticated technologies today that are connected into large databases like GuideStar. And they make available searches on those databases. They make them pretty easy for their DAF account holders to research charities. So if you're interested in making sure you're visible to a DAF donor, one of the smart things to do is go make sure your profile on those databases, like the GuideStar Candid database, is an up-to-date and current and well-written mission statement about who you are and what you do. And that's if somebody called into a DAF and said, how do you recommend your donors find me? The answer is going to be, we rely on databases. So make sure you're in those databases like GuideStar and maybe Charity Navigator and some others.
A client of mine just added I'm trying to remember the name of it, maybe you know, a button on their website that promotes donor advice giving through the donor advice fund? Is that something? That
yes. Anyway? So that's good. The product is that I'm aware of is called DAF Direct.
Yes.
And it is available. You can find it on dafdirect.org, I think, or dafdirect.com. It is as simple as you suggest. It's designed for a charity to put that link on their website. When the donor clicks on that and says, yes, I'd love to support you from my donor advised fund, then that widget, as we call it in the industry, will go out to your donor advised fund, because it you're going to log into your donor advised fund from that widget and make that transaction very simple and very easy. It's been around for a number of years and has had a reasonable adoption rate. And I think it's a fascinating technology that absolutely has some potential. And it's great for charities to put it out there as another way to remind donors who have donor advised funds that they can make a gift from their donor advised fund to the charity.
Good point.
Yeah. So Joe, let me jump to one thing that some sort of misinformation about donor advised funds and see where that goes in our conversation. I want to raise a question about pledges. I know it's a very unique thing, but it's an interesting dilemma that many people are confused about, and that's whether a pledge to a charity can be fulfilled with dollars from a donor advised fund. And the IRS has been clear about that early on. They've started to look at the subject again, and you might find various interpretations of, is it doable or not? That is, to fulfill a pledge from your donor advised funds. And the counsel I've always given people is you need to understand what the charity's going to do with that pledge. And if it's an intent to give, most charities are perfectly fine. Most DAFs, are perfectly fine accepting a grant request to fulfill a pledge, as long as the pledge doesn't have a legally binding side to it at the charity. And the extreme on that situation is if the charity is taking your pledge and going to a bank to borrow money to build a wing to an institution, a hospital or something, that constitutes a different kind of commitment of pledge dollars, the legal binding thing at the charity often. And that's where the IRS and DAFs begin to separate out your sort of annual fund pledge commitment as opposed to a building commitment. So pledges can be fulfilled from donor advised fund dollars, but you have to be careful, and often you can work very closely with DAFs and donors and figure out what the acceptable language will be. Usually the language is something as simple as the relationship between the donor and the charity is one that is carried forward by a statement of, I intend to recommend to my donor advised fund the issuance of a dollars to fulfill this pledge. And as long as that intent to recommend is there, that's the kind of language that DAFs and the IRS are okay with. So pledges are not taboo for charities to try to access dollars in donor advised funds. One of the other things I wanted to talk about was the fact that almost every donor advised fund has succession plans. There is an end of life plan for donor advised funds, an account at a donor advised fund. And in that regard, donor advised funds often offer a couple of different options for account holders who pass. And the question is going to be, what should we do with the funds in your account when you pass? For the donor advised account holder, the options are very often, I want you to just give it all away to charity X or charity X, Y, and Z at the end of my life. And that's fine. That's very clear. Oftentimes, charities extend the ability to pass the rights to advise on the account to another person, usually a child or a family member. And that's perfectly fine too. So if once I die, my account is going to be passed on to my daughter to manage that. And the third option that's common is the funds are passed along to the DAF hosting organization to be used at their discretion in whatever charitable purpose their trustees decide they want to use those. So the key message here is that $235,000 may still be available at a donor's end of life. And this is part of a planned giving conversation, estate planning conversation that charities ought to be having with their donors regarding DAF funds. So again, you find out one of your donors, a DAF holder, DAF account holder, a conversation about what they're planning to do with their DAF funds at the end of their life is a good conversation, because one of the big options is to just give those dollars to charity, and whether it's to a hospital or a school or whatever, the options are all out there for the donor to pick. Sometimes that's easier to make changes in your donor advised fund account succession plan than it is to go change your estate plan. So I know a number of financial advisors have actually said, let's just take all these things we want to give to charity at the end of life, and let's assign those and as create the beneficiary of the DAF to take on all of those assets. And then you can make the changes whenever you want to the succession plan in your DAF. And frankly, it's a whole lot easier and less expensive, because you don't need to get lawyers into those changes in your donor advised fund terms. So
you bring up a good point as far as how we can fund the account other than cash. Could we fund our donor advised account?
So any asset that you could be used to fund any charitable cause of any kind is available to be contributed into a donor advised fund. The very common ones are checks and wires. The tax beneficial ones are those that take advantage of the tax law, current tax laws on appreciated assets. So making a donation of shares of assets that you've held for a long time and have a great deal of capital gains liability because they've appreciated so much are a very smart tax benefit. You get the tax deduction of the value of the asset when you donate it, and within law, you can avoid the obligation of capital gains tax on the appreciated asset. So the obvious ones are securities, bonds, those kinds of things. But I think you're also poking at this subject of illiquid assets or complex non-cash assets, such as business interests, real estate. Their art collections are absolutely possibilities. There are different rules that apply to each one. Most good development offices know how to handle those things in charities. And if they don't, most of them have friends, partners, colleagues, other connections in the industry. They can call and say, I just got a call about this kind of property or this kind of asset, and how do I accept it? And so the donors can make the donation of almost any kind of asset to a charity. I know that's a generality, but it's appreciated assets certainly are a great benefit to make a tax gift of. And that can be done both real time today, as well as it can be part of what you gift as part of your estate. So gifting an illiquid asset from an estate is perfectly legit, and depending on your philanthropic goals and your tax situation, may be a smart play at the time of your estate settlement. You do want to have conversations with the charities involved if you're going to donate illiquid assets, because it would be a little awkward for your estate to call up Charity X and say, hey, I just got a whole lot of cryptocurrency that I want to make a donation of. How do you want me to send this? And the charity's put into a position of, well, we have a policy not to accept cryptocurrency, if that's their gift acceptance policy. And then you end up having various conversations with lawyers and probate courts and so forth sometimes about how do we finish this estate, because I've got a charity that can't accept cryptocurrency or whatever. So having a conversation with a charity about your estate plans is always a good thing for the donors and the charities.
Let me a couple questions around everything you just said. Mm-hmm. So isn't the, first of all, wouldn't the donor advised fund provider, for lack of a better word, wouldn't they give you counsel, give the donor counsel on how to donate illiquid asset?
Yes. Yeah. So a DAF, certainly almost all of them will be strong in their ability to counsel a donor or a financial advisor on gifting illiquid assets or assets of any kind. The piece most of those organizations are going to be very careful about is not providing tax advice, because they don't know your particular tax situation. So they will tell you correctly the opportunities and the benefits of making a gift of that kind of thing, whether it is truly a great gift for you and your family and your estate, that really comes back to you and your CPA and attorney and your village of advisors that each one of us has. But the DAFs, they'll know, you know, the benefits of a real estate gift or gifting shares of something you've owned for 20, 30 years, or even something you've owned for 3 years. They'll know the benefits and can speak to those to help you understand the kind of benefits, tax benefits you can get out of those gifts.
Now, are they not serving as like a clearinghouse? So if I donate whatever, a piece of artwork.
Yep.
They're going to liquidate it right away.
You actually get into an interesting question of the use of donor advised funds for a number of people in a number of situations. I know we did a survey a number of years ago and talked to 25 donors of our organization and found out that many of them made their gift because of a life event. And I would include in estates. They were given a large estate situation that had to be given to charity, so they chose to put it into a DAF. Somebody else was in a mergers and acquisitions situation. They got a wealth of stock, and they decided that rather than accepting that stock, they wanted it to be given to a DAF in their name that they could advise on. And so oftentimes somebody has an asset that they don't want to give to one charity. They want to split it up into five different gifts or 15 different gifts. Using a donor advised fund is a great device for that, because it's a classic. I'm going to put X dollars, $200,000 into a donor advised fund. And then I want to, at my discretion as the donor, begin to parcel that out. Some of it may be $5,000, some of it may be $500, but taking what I referred generically as sort of a big rock and donating that into a charity, whether it's a big stock or not, and then beginning to parse it out from there is a very common use, and oftentimes the first use of a DAF for many people. I talked to a college a number of years ago, and I said, look, if somebody gave you an island off the coast of Maine and said, I want you to keep 30% of the value when you sell it, and then I want you to send it. I want you to send five other gifts out to other organizations. Would you do that? And the college said, well, if the number was big enough, we probably would, but that's really not our business to be breaking up these gifts and sending dollars from our college off to this college in Charleston or this college or a hospital in Philadelphia. So that sort of breaking up the big asset into smaller gifts opportunity is a very common strategy that people use donor advised funds for. Yes.
So, but unless I started daydreaming, did you address? We are recording this the day before a holiday weekend. So
there you go. Yep.
So, but again, so the appreciated asset, I donated to whoever, Vanguard, Fidelity. I'm not
right
anybody over others, but they're taking care of it, right? Is it like, I know you're, you want to explain your connection with Brian Klontz? Connected in any way to what we're talking about?
Yep. Two things. One, when you make a donation to a donor advised fund like Fidelity, Schwab, any of them out there, you are making a classic tax deductible charitable contribution. And so you are losing, in return for getting that valued tax deduction, you are losing control of the asset. So ultimately, this is an asset that Fidelity, Vanguard, and PT are controlling, and they manage at their discretion, but you have advisory rights. So thus the name donor advised fund. A lot of these organizations have gift acceptance policy for risk and liabilities reasons where there are assets they won't accept. And so one of the things that I also do is assist Brian Klontz and his business at Charitable Solutions, helping charities manage gift donations that may be outside of gift acceptance policy. And I'll use a classic example that happened right here in Princeton, actually. A number of years ago, a donor wanted to give to the local community foundation a gas station that he owned. And as soon as you hear the word gas station, everybody sort of takes a deep breath and says, why would anybody want to accept a gas station? And so the local community foundation was sort of at a crossroads on how to deal with this gift. Well, this is exactly the situation that Brian Klontz and his business Charitable Solutions can jump into. They are a charity. They are, frankly, a DAF. And so the gift in that situation was donated to the Decamai Foundation down in Brian's business. Brian found a new buyer, liquidated it, and advanced the proceeds over to the local community foundation once the sale was completed. And in many of these situations, it's a matter of liability and risk. The local community foundation here said, look, the fact that there could be an oil leaking oil tank under there just takes this out of the realm of acceptability to us. Brian, however, has a business that deals with those situations. And we can get into very complex arrangements, artwork collections where people want to make sure that it stays, that, and this is outside of my expertise, but art that they want to maintain in a way for public visibility. There are ways to move that to other charities, benefit, charitable gifts, and so forth that I'm not an expert on, but Brian works on those kinds of things. We also talk at Charitable Solutions about gifts of these illiquid assets to fund annuities, to take one of these assets and actually change it into an income stream for life for a donor. We had a great situation we were working on recently where a donor in California had a property and they wanted to live in it for the balance of their life. So they wanted to donate the value of that property to a charity at the end of their life. As you know, that's called a retained life estate. And not an uncommon gift. So the charity accepts the asset, the real estate, but they allow the donor to live in it until the donor dies, at which time the charity has full right to do whatever they want with that real estate, oftentimes to sell it for the proceeds. So what was fascinating about this deal was we were able to craft not only this retained life estate situation, but because of the value of the property and the expected value at the time of the donor's passing, as well as whatever the rate tables say about end of life expectancies, we actually were able to extend an annuity to the donor collateralized by the real estate gift, the retained life estate. And the donor ended up with, is now getting $65,000 a year. And Charitable Solutions will end up with, actually owns today, at the end of this donor's life, they'll have a property worth valued over $1 million that they have been directed by this donor to distribute to four or five other charities once they sell it for the proceeds. So we can take complex situations and build creative solutions that most charities would say either this is too complex or we're not really in the annuity business because we don't have a big enough pool of people or any number of other creative legal charitable contribution situations. And that's what we do with charitable solutions. And that's adds to the interesting angle of the business that I'm trying to help charities with is, one, how do we tap into these funds that are at donor advised funds? That's one pathway. And the second pathway is these illiquid asset gifts. How can we participate in these gifts? But we've got gift acceptance policies that say we can't accept these properties. They're glowing. That's not going to be something we can accept, or we don't have the expertise to accept these. So that's the sort of the two parts of what I'm trying to help nonprofits with, is tapping into these two different approaches to generally larger gift opportunities.
When you say glowing, was that a nuclear waste reference?
Well, there's some green slime over there on the side of the property.
Fluorescent.
I don't know what's creating the green. Yes. Yeah.
Well, our listeners that are PG nerds are loving this.
Yeah.
And what else do you think people are not talking about out there? I mean, you brought up some good points in the outlines. What did you mean by payout ratios?
So one of the topics of conversation about DAFs has to do with the subject of money being donated to DAFs and DAFs not being what I sometimes refer to as a street mission, like a hospital charity, hospital, college, university, the food banks, and those kinds of things. And they're holding that money for an extended period of time. It's really just moving the money into another savings account. And the knock against DAFs is that the money's just sitting there and not going out to the out to the street. The numbers as reported in the NPT report recently were very clear, and we've known this for a while, is DAFs are giving out roughly 20% of the assets they manage every year, and have been doing it for a number of years, separate from foundations who have an obligation by law to give out at least 5% of their foundation money. The foundation money that's out there in the street today is about $800 million in foundation money. $800 billion. DAF dollars are about $110 billion. So foundations outsize DAFs in assets by about 8 times. Foundations are only obligated to gift out to charity 5% of their assets. The actual experience in the donor advised fund has continued to be over 20% of the assets are being given away. So comparing DAF assets and payout ratios versus foundations, I'm always curious as to the pressure being put on DAFs for payout ratios and getting the grants out as quickly as possible versus the foundation side, which tends to be much quieter and not spoken about. And partly because it's interesting, because there's legislation on the foundation side that says at least 5% have to go out. The actual number that goes out is very close to the 5%. I think I was looking at yesterday, it's 7 or 8% of, on average, of foundation dollars are gifted to charities a year. There is no requirement today on DAFs for a payout ratio, but DAFs very generally are trying to get the money out. They continue to improve technology to make it easier to give money to charities, and they're experiencing and continue to experience a 20% payout rate against the assets that they have. So it's an interesting conversation that's going on in the industry about DAF payout ratios and how do we get more money out to charities. So payout ratio is a common conversation in the DAF space.
It's great. I've never heard anybody talk about that. Something we didn't talk about talking about, but you're doing, tell me about I'm intrigued by the Am I saying it right? Basically a DAF, a white labeled DAF. Is that a right way to say it?
Yes. Yes. So one of the things, back to the number side of things, the growth in donor advised fund accounts has been growing at a very strong rate over the last couple of years. Contributions into donor advised fund accounts has been growing at about a 16% clip over the last couple of years, which is a considerably higher clip than overall charitable contributions. So a good amount of the charitable contributions that are going on are moving into DAFs. And so that's where the goal here has been, how do we, I lost a train of thought here. What was your question again?
Sure. The white label.
White label. There you go. So that growth quickly of all of these assets into DAFs is raising the flag to charities to say, how do I participate in this growth? I want to be part of this 16% growth. Should I go create my own DAF? So charities all over the country are raising this question of, should I start my own DAF? White label, or often sometimes referred to as private label, very common reference to, I can't do it myself. How do I build a DAF and use other partners to help me manage my DAF? So a charity X might choose to have a DAF, have donations made to them as a legal institution, but manage that, the underlying pieces of that, through an outsourced partner. And so the white label refers to sort of that, using a third party to manage the DAF. All the policies are the policies of the charity. None of that's changed, but the idea is, I have a DAF. And most people say, oh, that must be the same as the big guys. And the answer is, well, it is, in that we have the same responsibilities to manage the policies and procedures, but we don't actually have staff in our building that are managing those steps, those grant approvals and so forth. So white label is really just sort of, is just a way of managing a DAF. For the average donor, a white label DAF means nothing different than a big DAF that by one of the big organizations who handles everything themselves.
So why would a charity want to do that?
Well, they want to get on the bandwagon of growth. They're seeing all the 16% contributions going in there. They also want to tap into the loyalty of their donors, because a school or college might want to have a DAF because they have a very loyal donor base who has maybe a big asset they want to donate, and add into the endowment of the hospital, the university, the whatever. And so offering a DAF with whatever terms might be as attractive for an alum to support their university with a DAF as it is to support one of the national organizations that has a DAF or somebody else. So oftentimes on the backside, we think of the university is relying on a white label program, which is they manage the program, but somebody else is doing the sausage making in the back room of the activities of the DAF. Charities are looking at this question of, should I start my own DAF, all the time now because of the growth of charitable contributions into the broad DAF space.
So let's say my alma mater opens up a white label DAF. Are they, stupid question, but I'll ask it anyway. Won't be the first and last stupid question I ever asked. Is the money that I'm putting in that just going to the university, or is it like going to one of the other providers?
It's a terrific question, and the answer is it depends on the DAF. It's all within their policies and terms of what they want to do. So the recommendation for anybody that's opening a DAF is, make sure you read the fine print and make sure you understand where the money can go from the DAF that you're signing up for. And I will tell you that there are universities who allow you to make gifts in, and set a rule that say half of the money has to stay within the four walls of our university. But the other half of the money you put into a DAF at your alma mater can be gifted off to any charity you want, or they might put some restrictions on it. They might put a restriction on it that says if the gift you want to send, we're a faith-based university, and if your gift you want to send out is not going to support something that's consistent with our doctrines, we're not going to issue a check to that charity. Every DAF is allowed to write its own rules in terms of gifting and those kind of policies. And you can find single mission DAFs. I'm going to use one. I'll make it generic. So there's a national health charity that has a DAF, and you can donate to them, and some of the money stays there, whether it's 75% or 25% or 100%. And if you ask to gift money away from that DAF, but you want to gift it to smoking promotion programs, they're going to say, no, that's inconsistent with our policy, and we are not going to issue that DAF. So everybody's free to write their own rules in the terms of who they will support in the charitable space. And it's a buyer beware situation. Make sure you put your money into a DAF that's consistent with what your policy interests are and so forth. I will say that in a number of DAFs, one of the interesting business dilemmas is that the barrier to exit of a DAF, especially the major DAFs, is virtually nothing. It's just another grant to a different a charity or another DAF. If you're in DAF A and you don't like the terms and conditions, and you have the ability to issue a grant to another DAF, assuming that's within the rules of the DAF, you can just say, I don't like this anymore. I'm going to move my money over to this DAF. And frankly, it's not an uncommon practice amongst the big charities as well. But the barrier to exit for some of these funds is simply a grant request that gets approved.
For whatever's in my account, I've got 20 grand in the account. You know what? I'm moving on. Granted $20,000 to this. These are all 501c3s, right?
Yes, exactly right. So if you're in one of the major DAFs and you get solicited by your alma mater and they say, hey, it'd be really great if you opened up a DAF with us, you might say, all right, I'm out of this one. I'm just writing a check off and starting a new DAF over at my alma mater.
So what I'm trying to think of what's in it for the donor or why they would want to do this. So I'm just imagining that if, let's say, I had some tax issues, I needed the write-off, I wanted to put all the money in to something right away, but maybe I didn't want the university, as an example, to spend all the money right away, and I wanted to tell them, all right, you know, right now, put it towards this science project, and then down the road, we'll see what the priorities are in a couple of years or a year. Alan, we'll put it towards something else.
So there could be any number of drivers that keep your money in one DAF or move them to another. It could be investment options. You just like the investment philosophy of DAF A versus DAF B. You may be wanting to see what the strategy of DAF B is over time. So the university's DAF may have some restrictions in the rules where you don't want to put all of your dollars into those restrictions. You may also decide you want to see how the charity does, that DAF or that charity does, in managing those funds. And so you want to give them out $10,000 a year and build up your DAF at the expense of the first one to get comfortable with what they're doing. And again, back to the investment option, you may find that DAF B has an investment option that's not available at DAF A. And so you've decided you want to have 20% of your portfolio in hedge funds, and DAF A, where you started, doesn't have a hedge fund option for you. So you might take 20% of those dollars and move them off to another DAF or some other impact investing opportunity in the charitable space that would use those funds consistent with what your interests are.
Excellent.
Yeah. A lot of flexibility and very low cost for the most part to be in a DAS space.
Great. Anything else that you'd want to leave to our listeners?
You know, there's a lot of information here, and you and I, we know each other well enough. We could talk for hours on these things. I think one item on the illiquid asset gift side of things that I'd raise up is there is a great book that Brian Klontz has put together that I'd want, I would offer up to people to think about. It's called Complex Non-Cash Gifts. It's available as a download on his website at charitablesolutionsllc.com, but also it's available at Amazon. What's interesting about it is it's the chapters on how to have a conversation with a donor about illiquid asset gifts. We often get questions about, I don't know how to talk to anybody about real estate gifts. It's not something I'm really an expert on all the nuances, or somebody's got a business interest in an S corporation and what's special about S corporations. And this book actually has a couple of sections on how do you have these conversations with donors? What are some of the nuances you need to be aware of? It's updated for cryptocurrency, and knock on wood, cryptocurrency may be coming back as an appropriate appreciated asset for donating to charities here in 2019. So I think that's the other thing that I'd want people to be aware of, is there are resources out there, both people and written resources on these illiquid assets, as well as you said right at the start, a lot of conversations going on about DAFs. So there are people you can talk to get perspective and help on these things.
By the way, that's like a 450-page book that you wrote.
Yes, it's not too small. It's not.
Yeah. That's really, I can't imagine how long that took them to do that.
Yeah. And the proceeds on that, knock on wood, advertisement go to the American College. They don't go to Brian or any of the other authors. So it's going to a charity, all the proceeds of the of that book. So it's a great resource for people to have at their desk.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Brad, this is excellent, excellent. Really well done.
Okay.
Thank you. How can people get in touch with you?
I'm available. Best thing to do is to reach out to me on through Acadia Squam's website. And my email is brad.caswell@acadiasquam.com. You can just find us at that website as well. Happy to talk to people about many of these subjects. And you know, with 12 years of working as the transaction guy at one of the large DAFs, I've got some perspective and experience on some of these things, including the illiquid asset gifts too. So I'm happy to talk to folks if they've got questions. And Joe, thank you for doing this. This is a great service to the industry and to these conversations that you're having, the subject of these conversations.
My pleasure. Thanks for being a great guest.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Gift Planning Development Podcast. For more information on any of the topics you've heard about today, please go to giftplanningdevelopment.com.